Hello, my name's Paul DiFilippo, author of the Steampunk Trilogy, and you are listening to the SF Signal Podcast.
This is the SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name's Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And this is episode number 36, an interview with science fiction and fantasy author Paul DiFilippo. John DiNardo, resident blogger at sfsignal.com, and myself were fortunate enough to grab some time with Paul and chat with him about his various projects and his life and all other kinds of good stuff. So, without any further ado, let's jump right into that interview. And tonight we have with us a very special guest, Mr. And I know I'm gonna mess up your name, and I apologize. Let's see if I do it right. Paul DiFilippo.
That's perfect.
Oh yes.
That's that I am sure is the Italo-American pronunciation. I'm sure in Italy they would laugh both of us off the street if we pronounced my name that way. But that's how I grew up pronouncing it, so it's got to be.
Understood. You know, and I have a Sicilian uncle, and I can tell you that they never ever correct you on anything.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. That's the laissez-faire Mediterranean ambience.
I could also be using sarcasm. So you, John DiNardo is also with us. Say hello, John.
Hello, John.
And we're very happy to have you here tonight. You've written a lot of novels and a lot of short stories. I think more short stories.
Yeah, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years now. That's a weird and strange thing to say. It kind of creeps up on you. But, you know, if you prorate the stuff over 30 years, it's still substantial. It doesn't, on a day-to-day basis, I'm always chastising myself that I should be doing more. But I guess I'm happy with what's out there. And it does seem pretty substantial. I've had, I guess, maybe 25 books in 25 years. So that's gotta be a fair to Midland record. It's not it's not Robert Silverberg, but it's not James Tiptree either. It's
it's good.
The middle. Yeah, in the middle. I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
So how'd you get started?
Well,
What made you want to write? Who were your influences?
Well, it's one of those classic scenarios, you know, just an inveterate SF reader, you know, since I was probably 5 years old reading Tom Swift or whatever, and then just into the hardcore heavy duty stuff. And then a notion that maybe I could do some of this literature, produce some of this literature that I enjoyed so much. And writing, you know, it's almost a cliched scenario, writing for the high school and college newspapers. But then my first professional sale was to a little magazine that, in retrospect had kind of an immense footprint, for its size. And that was Unearth magazine, which, some folks might know it, some might not, but it printed, it's the stipulated mission of Unearth was to discover new writers. And so it had a pun in its title, obviously. They were unearthing new writers and they were producing unearthly stories. And that was the stipulated goal of this magazine. It was published out of Boston, so it was kind of local to me. And they printed the first stories of myself, William Gibson, Jim Blaylock, Rudy Rucker, who else? A few other names that are escaping me at the moment. But they had a great track record. They just were in the right place at the right time and managed to nab some first sales. And so my first story sold to them in 77.
Wow.
So yeah, so it's a bit over 30 years now. And from there, I actually had a long hiatus between first and second sales because I was busy with college. And, you know, the first one was a little bit of a fluke and I didn't really pursue it that that heavily. So I didn't really get going again until about 82. And then it's been kind of steady.
I'll say. I just scrolled down through your website, through the short stories, and it's like scroll.
Well, you know, it's I forget what the current account is. I don't count everything because somebody told me, well, what about all your humor columns? Those are little tiny flash fictions. And I said, well, they're not stories. A story is like, you know, something really substantial and hefty and stuff. But I guess if you toss those into the mix, it's well over 200 by now. So, but I look at, you know, I try to stay humble. I look at people like, you know, writers I've admired for so long. I mean, Michael Moorcock. How do you measure yourself against Michael Moorcock? It's just not possible. He's just done so much and such great stuff. So,
well, it depends. If you're leaving a convenience store at the same time he is, you could measure yourself on the. You know.
There you go. Well, we won't make any bad jokes about about Michael losing stature from his foot troubles. I mean, he. I don't know if you guys are on top of all the news, but he had some recent foot surgery, so we could. Mm-hmm. And I only joke about it because he is totally at ease with joking about it himself. You know, talking about selling off the amputated bits as holy relics. And,
I saw that. I saw that. Yes.
So, but anyway, no. Michael is one of my heroes, and you know to. Hang out with him the few times I've been lucky enough to do that. It's just been immense payback for everything.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah,
it is.
Well, I still, you know, I grew up a total fanboy, and you know, all of a sudden you're sharing a drink with Chip Delaney or some other hero of your youth, and it's just there's a bit of cognitive dissonance. You know, I still feel like the new kid on the block sometimes. Mm.
Let's talk just for briefly. The most recent thing I read of yours is Return to the 20th Century.
Yeah, that has an interesting history. There's a wonderful small press called Black Coat Press, and I don't know if you guys know their work. They're still you know pumping out the titles, but their mission is to promote. Francophile SF, you know, SF that was written by French nationals or has to do with France somehow, and it's run by Jean-Marc L'Officier, who's a very you know talented writer in his own right, and this is his small press. So he has a series of original anthologies, and the stories have to revolve around. French subject matter or great French fiction of the past. So this, my story, Return to the 20th Century, was commissioned for that.
Well, what struck me was it felt like a throwback, uh-huh. to like the classic science fiction. Yeah. You know, they're gonna build a bridge to the moon.
Right. Well, that it's a mashup of a very wonderfully bad. SF movie and a classic work of French literature. So I figured, you know, France and Hollywood, two great tastes that taste great together.
Jungle Alley, I could see hanging out with Alan Quartermain.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks. You know,
seriously. I mean, it was very cool. And I suggest people go out and check that out.
Yeah. It's in ebook form now, which maybe is how you ran across it.
It is. Yes.
Yeah. 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 And I think it's in one of my collections. I can't. I think maybe Harsh Oasis or the one. I'm blanking.
How do you decide? You know, when you sit down at the and I don't know if you use a computer, if you use a typewriter, or what you're doing. Hopefully, since you're on a Mac, you're using Scrivener. But when you sit down and you decide to start a story, I mean, what drives that? Where do you pull your inspiration from?
Well, you know, ideally, if I'm just sitting down to write the latest to transcribe the latest bee in my bonnet, so to speak, that you know is just motivated by a host of circumstances, something that you know, something is nagging at me, some either set of characters or theme or something topical. And so those kind of considerations would drive me to the keyboard. But lots of times, like with this Return to the 20th Century, you know, an editor calls and says, you have to do some kind of Francophile SF story. And so your remit is laid out right in front of you. I mean, it gets to be pretty narrow and focused, and then you just have to kind of hone in on what's being commissioned from you. So there's actually kind of two ways that a story gets generated. You know, obviously either commissioned or just free form inspiration. You know, I keep a series of notebooks, ideas and places and character names and stuff. And occasionally, if I'm stuck, I'll just start riffling through those pages and see. I'll say, oh yeah, that was a great idea. You know, that really struck me at the time, and it kind of fled to the back of my mind, and now I want to, you know, resurrect it and tackle it.
Hmm. Well, I know John is dying to ask you about steampunk.
Well, actually, I kind of was. So, yeah. You know, steampunk is kind of in a little mini heyday, if you want to call it that. But
steampunk is taking over the world. It's really nobody, I think, would have predicted it, you know, 30 years ago.
But back in 1995, you published the Steampunk Trilogy. So, what was that? I mean, I'm not that familiar with the roots of steampunk. Was that one of the first steampunk books around, or did you draw influences from others, or how'd that come about?
Well, here's what happened. My book is the first to use the word steampunk in the title, and lots of times because of that precedence, people think I invented the word, but of course I didn't. The history of the word is pretty well established. I mean, just a quick trip to Wikipedia will probably turn it up. The term was coined by K.W. Jeter, and it was actually a derisive kind of term. He was saying, you know, we've got punk this and punk that, and what's next, steampunk? And then he, the term the Big Bang, which was actually, I don't know if many people recall that the Big Bang was a derisive term also. It was coined by Fred Hoyle, the famous astronomer / SF writer. And Hoyle had an opposite theory to the Big Bang. He was a believer in the steady state theory. And so he said he coined the term Big Bang as a derisive term for his opponents. And it came to be standard nomenclature. So in any case, that's an obvious sidetrack here. But steampunk existed before Jeter coined the term, obviously. Nobody really had an overarching terminology for it. But as soon as he coined that term, everybody in retrospect said, oh yeah, this is Moorcock's The Land Leviathans is steampunk, and Christopher Priest's The Space Machine is steampunk, and so forth and so on. So there were, you know, quite a few precedents that people quickly began mapping out. And I said, you know, I've always loved that kind of fiction. Let me try writing some. And I did three novellas, and they all had magazine appearances. And then that was actually my first book. I collected those three novellas together. And there are very minor continuity linkages between them. You have to look at them with a microscope, but you can see that they're actually all set in the same universe. But it's very, you don't need to read them with that in mind. So having written these and collected them, I became inadvertently kind of a steampunk pioneer.
That's cool, though.
Would you say that steampunk has changed much in those, you know, 16 years since?
Well, it's gotten a lot more sophisticated and diversified. I there was really only there were always two ways of doing steampunk in the early days. There was the kind of gonzo fantasy related steampunk that Jim Blaylock did and I did. I think that's pretty much how I would classify mine. And then, of course, there was the much hotter nuts and bolts steampunk of the Difference Engine, you know, Stirling and Gibson's The Difference Engine. And that was much hotter to do and consequently much less frequently seen. So there were those two modes. And I think in the ensuing years, it's really kind of fractionated and diversified. I don't know if I have any handy labels for all the sub niches, but I know in my head that there are a bunch of different flavors of steampunk now. And so it has kind of ramified, and there's something for everyone, I think.
Well, now tell us just a little bit about the steampunk trilogy itself. I mean, you used the word for the first time, but you know, what about the story?
Well, it's three novellas, Victoria, Hottentots, and Walt and Emily. And, the first story involves, an imaginary protagonist, a person who never really existed, but he interacts with a lot of, you know, core figures from the Victorian period, notably Queen Victoria. And the genesis for that, and that was the first one written, was actually me playing the Kinks Victoria over and over, and just through headphones, and just saying, how can I possibly capture the manic energy of this song on the page? So that's kind of a little hidden genesis to that story that not many people know of. And so then, having written that, I realized that so much of the Victorian period, the reality of it, the history of it, offered even greater weirdness and strangeness than I could possibly invent. So for the next one, Hottentots, I started doing some, you know, fairly heavy research, and I used a real person as my protagonist, Professor Louis Agassiz, a famous naturalist. And then finally, in the third piece, Walt and Emily, I used, once again, I stuck with that, you know, letting reality or the history kind of guide my narrative choices. And I chose Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson as my protagonists.
Nice.
Well, I've come to see that, you know, the old cliche about truth being stranger than fiction really does apply in many cases, and you can often let the historical record shape your narrative in strange ways if you just twist it and tweak it a little bit.
Kind of leading off of John's question about how steampunk has changed, do you find yourself reading any of the steampunk that's out there today?
Oh yeah, I still love to read it. There's a fellow Stephen Hunt, I think is his name. Stephen Hunt does great stuff. I just read Spring-Heeled Jack by
Mark Potter.
Debut novel, very excellent steampunk. And but my favorite, and this goes to show how mutated and bizarre the genre has become, is Aurora-rama by it's funny, we're continuing the French theme here. It's by a fellow French author named Valtat, Valtat. I'm pretty sure that's his name. And but Aurora-rama is just brilliant, and you want to talk about brilliant, he's a French native, and he wrote the entire book in his second language, English.
Wow.
And it's like, it reads like, I don't know, like Nabokov or one of those other great writers who came to English as a second language, like Conrad or Nabokov or something. It's just brilliant to think that it wasn't even his native tongue.
That had to be rough.
Mm.
Hey, Paul, tell us about your Barnes & Noble gig.
Well, this is something... excuse me.
Sure.
This is something I've been doing for... It's maybe 2.5 years now. Let me have a sip here.
Mm-hmm. John, do you want to serenade us for a minute?
Yeah. It's...
no, thank you.
What happened was Barnes & Noble, the bookseller, had a website. It looked just like the Amazon page. You know, it was basically a giant virtual store.
I think it was actually the same software.
Was it? I never knew that.
I think in the beginning it was. I think in the very beginning it looked so much like Amazon. I think it was the same software.
It's funny. They must have gone to the same developer, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, they said, how can we enhance this site? Let's add some original content. And so they created the Barnes & Noble Review. And it's unfortunate because I don't think it's publicized enough. It's just a little button at the top of the main page, and you click on it, and all of a sudden, you're in a literary magazine. They have tons of reviews, you know, fresh every week by just some of the best, you know, critics around. There's a woman named Laura Miller, whose stuff is great. And there's Michael Durda, my friend from the Washington Post, who's just like the most omniscient literary person around. He's read everything under the sun and can, you know, say interesting things about it. He does a column, and they have music reviews. And in any case, it's just a wonderful little literary magazine. And in this day and age, when review coverage is shrinking, at least, you know, there's plenty of amateur reviews of varying quality. But when professional review coverage is shrinking, you know, newspapers cutting column inches left and right, it's wonderful to have this resource. And the thing is, they love, they let me cover science fiction and fantasy and other strange things. I just reviewed a book about the history of ping pong and a strange doctor who made his specialty was things that people swallowed, bad things that people swallowed, nails and you know, other bizarre things. And that was his specialty, was helping these patients. But he collected everything that he removed from his patients, and it's in a little museum down in Philly or someplace. And this person, you know, a nonfiction author, wrote a book about this strange guy and his career. And so they let me cover. You know,
I'm not looking forward to the sequel. The sequel is about the proctologist.
Exactly. Somebody mentioned that. I think Arthur Lavati, the well-known fan, told me that was going to be the sequel that he was going to put together. But so Barnes & Noble, the Barnes & Noble Review, it's right up there at the top of their main page, just a click away. And my current column just went up this week. It's a review of Swamplandia, the debut novel of this young woman who I probably – shouldn't highlight her age too much for fear of making envy among every other writer on the planet. She had her short story collection out when she was like 20, 22 or 24. And this, I think she's 27 now. And this brilliant debut novel, Swamplandia, is just out. So that's my column this week.
Hmm. We would be remiss if we did not also ask you about WikiWorld.
WikiWorld is one of my favorite recent stories, and this is, you know, after writing SF for 30 years, you know, you start to worry that you could be falling into a rut or repeating yourself. That's something we all have to guard against. And with WikiWorld, I really set out to kind of reinvent my voice and just to get as topical and not trendy, because trendy has kind of a bad connotation, but as topical as possible when at the moment when it was written. And I think I succeeded. It's gotten some good reaction from folks. It's basically about a future, a near-term future where the U.S., the government as we know it, has collapsed and the country is governed by something that looks very much like a wiki kind of model. So,
not too far fetched given our government these days.
Right. Well, you wondered, you know, could anything be worse? It may be time to, you know, all those airheads and ranters who want a new constitutional convention, I have little sympathy with their particular program, but sometimes you wonder if maybe we shouldn't just start from the ground up and see what we can come up with to meet new conditions.
Uh-huh. I really think that, you know, WikiWorld is one of those stories. I read that back in 2007, I guess, but it was just one of those stories that stands out in my mind as one of these ones that just really, really messes with your head. it was really well done. It's like, I think every once in a while, one of these stories comes along where it just totally, you know, makes you realize how, you know, what short fiction can do. You write, the majority of the stuff you write is short fiction. That's obviously the preferred space you play in, or, you know, is that a conscious decision, or just do the stories evolve that way?
It's funny. I see it all ties in with when I began writing. You got to remember the media or marketplace landscape of 1977. It was still that old paradigm. You hone your craft in short fiction, and then you make your splash in the various prosines, and then if you're lucky, you assemble a collection, and then you move on to novels from there. So I was still, that was basically my career path, but that doesn't invalidate your point. Is that I love short fiction. You know, you get in and out, and you warp some minds if you're lucky enough, and then you move on to the next target. So I do still love short fiction, and I'm hoping to start another novel this year, because I feel it's the one that got published in 2010 was written, you know, quite some time ago. I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. So I feel kind of rusty in the novel writing department.
Well, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You talk about the short fiction. I mean, obviously, you do extremely well there, because I always look at it as, you know, short fiction teaches you vocabulary.
Yes. Yep.
And I mean, you one of the things that Karen Burnham, one of our regulars, tells me is, you know, you got to build your world in two sentences.
Sure. Yeah, it's I always you know, tried for a certain information density in that was a big insight that Rudy Rucker provided to me when and to the world at large when cyberpunk was hot and flourishing. And he said, this is a literature of information density. You know, it's like how much bandwidth can you cram in to the story. So to me, that's a goal, you know, that I've been pursuing for not every story, because some stories are more simple and straightforward. But I think the best kind of SF, you look for a certain information density. And I always remember something that Chip Delaney said in one of his essays. He said, in the best science fiction story, every sentence accomplishes two separate things. You know, it might be a sentence that simultaneously reveals something about the character, but also about the bizarre environment that he's in. So that's another goal of mine, is to emulate that thing that Chip does.
Well, and I personally think you do that well. I mean,
oh, thanks.
And that kind of brings me around to just asking, you know, what are you working on right now? What do you have out? You know, what can we look forward to?
Well, there's a great new anthology that Gordon Van Gelder put together, which is just out, called "Welcome to the Greenhouse," and I have a story there. it's as you can guess, it's about climate change.
Sure.
And I have a story in there called "Farm Earth," and I think anybody who liked WikiWorld will enjoy this. It's very, very similar. It's a near-term future and strange new social paradigms and technology. And so that story's out there right now. It's been getting a few decent reviews as people pick up, you know, the whole volume. And I just got my contributor's copy of the, I don't think it's out on the newsstands yet, the new issue of FNSF. I think it's the March-April issue. I have a story in there. And Gordon, in his introduction, Gordon Van Gelder, the editor, kind of shamed me, said it's 9 years since Paul had a story in the magazine. I know it's I'm slacking or getting lazy or resting on my laurels is something I need to do. Well, you know, it's funny because I have the humor column in that magazine. It always feels like I'm there, and you know, in that 9 years, I've had scores of humor pieces in the magazine, so it feels like I've never been away. But in terms of something more substantial. The new piece is called A Pocket Full of Faces, and that's just out in the magazine. And I have my newest book publication is called A Princess of the Linear Jungle. It's a sequel to A Year in the Linear City, and I think it's kind of fun. It's about a doctoral student in this strange world who has a kind of Burroughsian adventure in the jungles of this world. So it's kind of a academic slash pulp novel.
Sounds great.
It's like Jane Smiley meets A. Merritt.
So that's all awesome. You know, our listeners should go check that out. Where can they find you online? What's your website?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's pauldefilippo.com.
They'll never find it.
It doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles. It's got a few a few essays and some links to free fiction and some of my mail art, which is a pursuit that makes me happy. It doesn't earn any money, but it amuses people who get these bizarre envelopes in the mail, and some of them are scanned and reproduced on the site. But I do a blog with four other people. It's called The Inferior Four Plus One. Don't ask the name. The name has a strange derivation, but it's on LiveJournal. So if you go to LiveJournal, look for The Inferior Four, and it's well worth going there because it's not just me. It's Lucius Shepard, although he's been slightly inactive lately. He's busy doing, you know, good paying stuff and instead of blogging. So he's been away for a while, but you can scroll through the archives and see some great posts from him. And it's Liz Hand is one of the co-authors, and Paul Witkover and Lisa Goldstein. So it's five totally different opinionated people holding forth.
And do you do any of the social media? Are you on Twitter or Facebook?
No, I don't. I have avoided that simply not out of any prejudice, but just as a matter of time. I mean, I see my friend Scott Edelman is a total social media hound, and I just see how much it consumes him. And I think sometimes he even has a little regrets or reluctance at how much it does consume him. And I just... I know if I dip my toe into it, it'll be a maelstrom that sucks me down. So I just kind of stay away.
I understand. You know, I'm always surprised with people like John DiNardo who just spend all their time on there. I mean, every time I go on there, he's online. It's just crazy.
What was that? I was just tweeting that we were interviewing Paul DeFilippo. Sorry, I missed that.
I was actually teasing him because I think I spend a little more time on there than he does.
Yes.
I actually thought it might be fun to use Twitter in a not that I'd be the first to do this, but in a kind of fiction oriented way, and offer some kind of ongoing serial narrative through a series of tweets, rather than, you know, just talking about myself or spewing out a stream of consciousness. Is to do something more quote unquote creative and fiction oriented on Twitter, but I haven't quite wrapped my mind around that yet.
You know who does that really well?
I'm sure somebody must have tackled it.
Brent Spiner.
Oh, all right. I'll have to track him down.
So the actor who played Data on Star Trek: The Next Generation, he does this. His Twitter feed is about I mean, it's just, it's silly, but it's like fake Brent's life.
Oh, that's great.
You know, and it slams Hollywood a lot, and yep. You know, there's all this weird stuff going on. For a while, he had this long kind of storyline running where it was he got involved with his neighbor's wife, and they had an affair, and then she wanted him to help kill her husband so she could get the money.
Wow.
And, you know, and it's just this long, drawn-out thing, and it's hilarious. Hilarious.
Well, look at, you know, there's been, what is it, the fake Steve Jobs
yep.
and others of that ilk. And so, but I was actually thinking of, you'd have to invent a real a character with a real good hook and then deliver the tweets as if they were from that character.
Yes. And that one, another one of my favorites is Goddamn Batman.
Ah, there you go. I need to do my research before I plunge into this.
There are some people doing it, and there's some people doing it well, and some not so well. Yep. You know, Goddamn Batman is a good one. Brent Spiner is another one.
Wasn't there a Hulk?
There probably is a Hulk. Yes.
Yeah, I think there was the Hulk offering his tweets on various topics.
Well, are you doing any conventions or signings or anything anywhere we can find you out in the world this year?
Well, curiously enough, I'm going to a convention this weekend, but it's not going to mean much to the readers who hear this 2 weeks later. So it's Boscone, the great long-term Boston convention. I don't have any conventions lined up currently except ReaderCon, great Massachusetts convention, and that happens in July. I'm pretty sure it's July. So
yeah, I think John and Elia went to that last year.
Yes, yeah.
Said it was a good one.
Yeah, they ReaderCon hit its 20th anniversary a year or two ago, and they have just it's a smallish convention. It's a huge ratio of professional people to literate, you know, brilliant fans, and we just have a heck of a time. Thrashing out the destiny of science fiction and fantasy.
Well, again, I want to thank you for coming on. Everybody should go to pauldfilippo.com and check out all your stuff and buy your books and buy the anthologies and the collections and everything.
Well, you guys are fighting the good fight and doing the Lord's work for science fiction. So I can't, you know, recommend your site highly enough. It's one of my first stops of the browsing every day.
Oh, thanks, Paul.
Great. Now I got to hear it from John.
My ego is expanding even as I speak.
Well, thanks again for coming on. Really,
my pleasure.
It.
You guys thanks, have Paul. A great week and a great weekend. Take
too.
Care now. Bye.
And there you have it, our interview with Paul DeFilippo. Thanks again for coming on, Paul, and thanks to John DiNardo for sitting in on that. I really appreciate it. And thanks to you guys for listening. You know, you're the reason that we're doing this. Hey, and if you enjoyed this podcast or any of our podcasts, there's a couple things you can do to help us out. Number one, you can visit our iTunes page. Give us a couple stars, write a review. Number two, you can tell your friends. Help us build some more listenership, you know. That always helps us. Number three, if you have any thoughts on this interview, you know, feel free to leave us a comment on the post or give us a call on our voicemail line, 720-277-9082. And if you don't want to make a long distance phone call, there's a flash widget on this post that you can just plug your number in and Google will call you and save you that dime. That's it for us this week. We'll be back next Tuesday with another panel and next Thursday with another interview. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week. Bye.